Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. For the next 25 minutes, we're going to talk about doctors, physicians, as a godly vocation. Harder to say that nowadays. Back when the healing arts were the healing arts, now they are not always that. Our call-in number is 505-7850-1800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address. It's issuesetc@kfuo.org. Uwe is a regular guest. He's an international journalist. He's director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. Uwe, welcome back.
Good to be here.
You know, there's a Lutheran pastor, George Tiller, who is, George Tiller, who is also renowned, notorious for being one of the most famous third-term abortion providers. And he might say, as a Lutheran doctor, he might say, look, my vocation is to save these unborn children the pain of entering this terrible world of poverty and stress and war and famine, and to help these women who come to us exercising their right of free choice. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, my heart bleeds enormously when I hear this, you know. I mean, here he says he must be also a clairvoyant. He must say, you know, I can see, me, Tiller, I can see that this child is going to be have a horrible life, is never going to meet an attractive woman, is never going to do anything, is going to be in pain and agony all his life. So I better take now, as the child is about to be born, insert a syringe, suck its brains out so that the head will collapse and then be able to be pulled out of the birth canal. It's better to murder than to envision a nasty life for the child, which I, as a soothsayer, of course, can predict. I mean, I've never heard anything, bigger garbage in my entire life.
We might have to go back a century, but up until that time, the healing arts, the physician, the doctor, even with less technology than we have today, was considered a godly vocation. It was much more hit and miss, but it was considered healing arts, helping and concern. What has happened to the vocation of physician?
Well, what happened to the vocation of physician is what's happened to so many other vocations, and that is that suddenly the vocation element, namely the idea that God calls us to do our work out of love for our neighbors, has been taken out of vocation. And with that, the natural law, something that I complained about, when we were discussing lawyers, for example, natural law, which is written upon every human being's heart, has been taken out of law and out of medicine and other things. Obviously, not all physicians, because there are obviously very many highly conscientious and loving doctors, and I certainly know a great many of those. But, I mean, if you hear this Lutheran just now, you know, says, well, it's better to kill than to have this kid risk a terrible future. It is absolutely, well, it's what the Greeks called diabolein, turning things upside down. It's what the devil got his name from.
Speaking of the Greeks, the Hippocratic Oath was not penned by someone who is conversant in the Christian faith, but it's a pre-Christian pagan philosopher who develops this idea to guide even primitive medicine in the ancient world. It was an oath that was, in one form or another, commonly employed in medicine. Right. In medical schools, it was taught as the ethos of medicine. When did that stop?
Well, I think it stopped with the concentration camps, basically. It stopped with Mengele in Auschwitz or Treblinka. It stopped when, actually here in the United States, which is where the idea of euthanasia first came up, which was then taken up by the Nazis, it stopped with that. And the interesting thing, if we, you mentioned Hippocrates, stated that a doctor should be saintly, and he vowed to be saintly. This is precisely what I mean by the by natural law, which is written upon our hearts. This is well before Christianity, but before Christ walked on earth. But the natural law that God has written on our hearts can be found in the Hippocratic Oath, which explicitly rules out abortion, explicitly rules out euthanasia. It says so in the Hippocratic Oath that I will not give give poison to even on demand, and I will not aid in an abortion. So it is really what we are seeing is really a disastrous development, which has thrown overboard 2,400 years of ethics.
You mentioned before that a doctor that believes it is better to kill must be claiming to be clairvoyant or omniscient. I'm wondering if it can also be understood as acting outside his godly vocation. That is, we do have vocations that are called by God, if necessary, to take a life. Police officers, soldiers, executioners. A judge can hand down a capital sentence.
Correctly.
And do this within the realm of a godly vocation. Seems to me a doctor who decides that a disabled person is a life not worth living, or that the unborn would be better off dead, is really trying to act in one of those vocations without a proper call to do so. He's trying to be a police officer or a judge or an executioner.
Well, correct. And here's something very, very interesting. You see, Luther has made this wonderful statement that we all in our secular functions are larvae dei, we're the masks behind which God acts in the secular world, in the left-hand kingdom. But then, so in this case, the faithful doctor, or even Hippocrates, who knew nothing about the God of Christianity or the God of Israel, nevertheless acted out in a saintly fashion. Now, the interesting thing is there is no in-between. Either you are the mask, you are God's mask, or you're the devil's mask.
There's no in-between.
There's no in-between. There is nothing. There's not what theologians call an adiaphron. It's nothing neutral. Either you're this or the other. And, I mean, this is what this gentleman who calls himself a Lutheran might want to consider. He might want to read Luther on this topic. So he is acting as a mask for something other than God.
You mentioned before the concentration camps. You mentioned Joseph Mengele, yeah. Famous names,
right.
About the horrors that the medical profession can turn to. That was medicine in service of the state. I mean, Mengele might have been a madman or a masochist or a sadist, but he was acting under orders of the state. This seems to be a dangerous thing when medicine acts in the interests of the state.
Well, in the interests, not actually even of the state. Don't forget that the concentration camps or the annihilation camps were not a state institution. There's no law. There was no law saying that the Jews had to be gassed. But German law functioned normally, and this was a very good law, it's Roman law. It was in the interest of an ideology that had usurped the function of a state. So, if you're a doctor and you're working in the interest of the state, state meaning an order of creation, then, of course, your function is to help. You act as a prison doctor. Come to that later, but as a prison doctor on behalf of the state to save a life or heal somebody or a police doctor or whatever it is, or state hospital. then the state is at the service of the individual, of God's creation. It becomes what Mengele and his ilk did was they acted on behalf of a substitute religion, which is an ideology. And the ideology was lethal. The ideology presumed to kill. So in the name of that religion, they killed.
How is it that a doctor can climb into his car in the morning and drive into an abortion clinic and with no more thought than a dentist pulling out a tooth,
yeah,
or a doctor, as you say in your article, going in to fix a hernia,
yeah,
can kill, and on a grand scale?
It is a massive illness. It is a spiritual illness that has beset our nation when a doctor can do that. If you, you just have to imagine what the abortion looks like. You have in your hand a live baby, especially the late-term abortions, and you yank it out and you strangle it. And there are cases where they're being strangled even after they're out of the birth canal. It is wanton slaughter. How this person can go to bed at night and sleep, how he can look himself in the mirror the next morning and shave himself, or if she's a woman, put her lipstick on her face, is absolutely beside me. And talk yourself into that, I'm helping that woman while I'm murdering the most innocent person in the one locus where the human being is as close to paradise as possible, as what is humanly possible, namely in the mother's womb. That is, I think, to me, such a perversion of our society and of a profession, of a vocation. It totally baffles me.
Talk a bit about the institutionalized forms of bad medicine or physicians acting, all people in medical profession acting outside their vocation, their God-given vocation. And I'm thinking here about the Netherlands, which is often the touchstone for how bad medicine can get in the 21st century.
Euthanasia is, I mean, here they pick up on something that the Nazis had introduced and that was the precursor of the mass murder of Jews and gypsies and others. Before anybody else was slaughtered, the so-called unworthy lives were taken away. Now, these were people who might have been mentally or physically handicapped, or in the Netherlands, of course, they claim that they only do this with the agreement or with the desire of the patient, which in itself is wrong, because I don't think it is a doctor's job to take a life. But even if you disregarded that, we know now from the Netherlands, there are plenty of reports there, that human lives are taken as a matter of course in case of terminal cancer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is against anything that for the last 2.5 millennia has been considered good medicine.
And yet the Netherlands is widely considered to be one of the most enlightened and civilized nations on earth. I mean, it's often pointed to,
yeah,
especially by the left in the United States, as a model of enlightened thinking, how a nation ought to conduct itself.
Yeah, but you have the key word here, enlightened. You see, the Enlightenment is, of course, what brought us into bad theology, what got us into a bad view of vocation. Enlightenment led directly to the French Revolution, which Dietrich Bonhoeffer explicitly blamed for man's descent into the worst depravity. The Netherlands, the Netherlands are learning fast now, because no country has been struck in Europe as much as the Netherlands by the Islamic onslaught. And all of a sudden they're seemingly beginning to wake up a little bit. And we know, I mean, I'm from Germany. In Germany, we observe very, very carefully what's happening in the Netherlands, because Christians in the Netherlands report very extensively on this mass slaughter of human life, on request, in quotation marks, or not. And most people keep saying now that it is not even on request, it is simply as a matter of course.
The Nazis had that ideology, that religion, the diabolical religion that you talked about,
right,
where Hitler, as wrong as he was, could make the case in Mein Kampf that the disabled, the weak, the retarded, all of the various things were a weakness in the body of the German people.
Yeah.
Therefore, they had to be eliminated like any other kind of weakness so that the German people could be strong and fulfill their destiny. At least there was an ideology there. Can you identify the ideology? I mean, it's not as though the Netherlands doctors are doing these things.
Same ideology. It's me. The ideology is that I am more important than anybody else who is created in the image of God. It's me. It is the Nazi system. I have had this very interesting exchange with an author just now from Canada. The Nazi system wasn't a right-wing system. It wasn't a conservative system. It wasn't something that was trying to conserve a religious or a Christian or even a humanistic ethic. The Nazi thing was a left-wing radical movement that placed the us in that particular case, us at the exclusion of the you, above the you, that considered compassion a sin from their own commandments. Compassion is wrong, and compassion is has to be chucked away for a superior society to survive. And superior society is obviously the society of those who are prepared to live within these parameters. And that is precisely what the Nazis did. And in a different way, but obviously as lethal a way as that, we have this now. It's the me. I am more important than a child I'm bearing. I am more important. My well-being, my love life, my sex life, my professional life, all these things are more important than the innocent life in a mother's womb.
More subtle and less extreme is what some might point to here in the West, with where medicine has become a commodity,
right,
or the patient has become a commodity. People will go into a doctor's office or they go into a hospital and they get the distinct impression, whether it's true or not, but they get the distinct impression that this is really more about the arrangement between the insurance company and the HMO and the hospital and the doctor, right, than it is about the kind of personal medicine. We often harken back to this kind of small town doctor making his house call,
right,
knowing the family, knowing the people's history, rather than the impersonal system that we have today. Is this also a way that the vocation of the healing arts can be violated?
Yes, it is definitely a way the healing arts can be violated. But here's a very interesting point to be made. Those who violate, to my knowledge at least, those who violate the healing arts ethos tend to be people who come out of the very ethos, the Judeo-Christian ethos, that introduced the notion of vocation. By the way, a notion that very much applies to Orthodox Judaism as it does to Lutheranism. On the other hand, I have found in my own experience that, for example, doctors, Indian doctors, who come out of not even a Christian culture, a non-Christian culture, are reintroducing this ethos of compassion for the for the patient, which is why one reason why Indian medicine is booming.
Uwe, finally here, you've mentioned several times here the foundation of natural law that is reflected in the Hippocratic Oath, that was reflected in medicine for so long. It was the often unexpressed basis for the whole way a physician or a nurse or a doctor would work with their patients. If natural law can go by the wayside in a calling, a compassionate calling like medicine, what hope does natural law have in any other vocation?
Not very much. I mean, this is why I feel that we are on a very, very, very dangerous slope. I don't believe that natural law can always fall by the wayside, because, I mean, I firmly believe that the God who inscribed natural law upon our souls will still see to it that natural law will prevail. But, please, 6 million dead Jews, 500,000 dead gypsies, 45 million dead babies over here, 3 million dead Cambodians, 35 million dead Chinese. You can go on and on and on. All this is as a result of natural law no longer being respected. And I don't know how this is possible, how you can simply overturn something that is part of your makeup as a human being, namely conscience, but evidently it's possible.
Finally, what is the physician's vocation?
The physician's vocation is to heal, to save lives, or where he cannot heal and cannot save life, at least make a patient as comfortable and suffer as little as possible.
Your general reaction, we were talking just a moment ago about the South Dakota law that bans abortion there, and rather, apart from its legal outlook or its legal prospects, what is your first reaction to hearing that the South Dakotans...
I rejoice because at least these legislators had a sense of natural law. Their heads in the right place, their hearts in the right place. That, to me, is very essential. And there's another interesting aspect which I don't think came up. Already now, there is not a single doctor in all of South Dakota who is prepared to perform an abortion. There is one clinic left, and the doctor who does that has to be schlepped in from next door from Minnesota. I think, you know, I'd like to go over to South Dakota and shake people's hands and say, what a marvelous bunch of people you are.
When we come back for this break, will you stick with us for a few minutes to take some phone calls on the other side? We'll take your phone calls, your questions, and your comments. Our guest, Uwe C. Minetto, has written an article on his blog called Called to Heal, Not to Kill. Just go to our website to find it. Click links, and you'll find a direct link to Uwe C. Minetto, issuesetc.org. Click on links. Scroll down. You'll find Uwe C. Minetto and the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation, issuesetc.org. Your calls, your email after this break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. After we conclude our conversation and your phone calls with Uwe C. Minetto, we've got more open lines for your questions and your comments. We're going to be hearing a little bit about the Da Vinci Code as time permits. There's a lawsuit brewing before the movie even comes out. We'll find out about that later. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Your phone calls after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you find it to be a struggle when you read the Old Testament? Lots of judgment, wrath, and punishment, and what seems to be very little grace, mercy, and peace. Well, you'll find our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February a helpful resource. It's the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. For more information, you can call Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number is 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more on our website, issuesetc.org. This new Bible commentary costs $42.99 plus shipping and handling. The Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel is written by Dr. Horace Hummel, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. How are the visions and oracles in Ezekiel relevant to God's people today? And where do we find Jesus in this Old Testament book? Find out with a Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February.
Creation in schools. No Bible, no problem.
Answers with Ken Ham.
president of the Answers in Genesis Ministry. Ken, I didn't think it was legally possible to teach about creation in public school science classes. Are you saying that something's different now?
Well, most would agree that it's not easy being a Christian teacher in today's secularized culture. During America's culture wars, the humanists have been successful in virtually outlawing the Bible and its teachings. But as a former public school teacher myself, I believe that Christian teachers can effectively teach against evolution without even mentioning the Bible or creation. They can simply teach students how to think, not simply how to pass a test. You see, I found that most science classes only instruct the students in what to think, not how to think. When you teach students the right way to think, they'll easily see that molecules to man evolution isn't observable science, but just a belief about the past. I made sure my students back in Australia understood what science is, but also what it isn't. I taught them that real observational science involved using your five senses in the present to build computers, space shuttles, and so on. But when you come to origins, you've just stepped outside of this sort of science. You're now dealing with the beliefs of scientists who were not there. I found that students quickly caught on, and they asked questions like, well, how can you know where we came from? What a great opening to give the answer. God created.
Ken has written a new booklet on effective evangelism. You can find it on our website, free of charge, at answersradio.com.
Dr. Peter Scare on how Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is unique.
We take seriously the words of our Lord, you know, that we are to be called to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. We are faithful to the Scriptures, and we are faithful to word and sacrament. We are both evangelical and Catholic. We are evangelical in that we believe the Word of God to be true, that we believe the Bible, and we're not going to back down from it. At the same time, we're Catholic. We recognize that this church has been around for 2,000 years. We also recognize that God is continuing to work through means, that He's working through the water of baptism, that He's working through the body and blood of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So we take seriously our mission to be a light and salt to the earth.
For more information on Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, go to their website, ctsfw.edu, or call them at 1-800-481-2155.
One of the most important doctrines, or one of the most important teachings, that we find among Christians in the church. Where can you find a summary of those doctrines? And is it a simple summary, or is it complicated? Let's talk about Luther's Small Catechism next time on The Bible Study with Pastor John Lukomsky. The Bible Study, weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We're talking about the lay vocation of doctor. As part of our lay vocation series, Uwe is an international journalist, director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. A few more minutes with him as we take your questions and your comments. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Herman. He calls from Illinois. Hi, Herman.
Thank you for taking my call. Two short comments. You mentioned a Lutheran making a comment about euthanasia to the effect. I didn't quite catch it, and I was just wondering if he was a member of the what's called the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And also, in the late 1960s, I was a student at the University of South Dakota at Vermilion. And while I was there, an incident developed where a medical student attending the School of Medicine attempted to perform an abortion on his girlfriend. And she died from an air embolism that was induced, and the state prosecuted him, and he did prison time for it. That was prior to Roe versus Wade.
Herman, thank you very much. Your question, George Tiller, the man I mentioned at the outset of our conversation, is reportedly a member of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in Kansas. So as to your first question, your reaction to the second part of his comment there, Uwe?
Well, this guy did prison time, rightly so. It's the least he should do. I do hope he has a guilty conscience for the rest of his life.
We were talking during the break about just a few undisputable facts. Abortion clinics have a very difficult time holding on to employees. Maybe the abortionist is a steady, but they have a hard time holding on to nurses, receptionists. There seems to be a force of gravity with natural law and the human conscience that gets in the way of people doing this kind of heinous activity in the name of medicine.
Yes, I'm told that it's totally traumatizes nurses who participate in these operations. They go absolutely nuts, and they simply don't seem to be able to hold to stick on with that job, understandably so, because I mean they're the ones who are throwing these murdered babies into the trash cans or the mangled bits that come out. And yes, it is natural law because people are, as I said before the break, people are born with a conscience, which is the natural law that's written upon our hearts. If you suddenly see, I mean, you know, you already feel horrible if which happened to me. I once killed a cat with my car, and you know, here's that cat, and is was actually not dead yet, so I drove over again to make sure that was dead. But I mean, you know, I have had a trauma, and this was a cat. And here are people who yank out babies several a day, day after day. Obviously it traumatizes them. And as you said, even receptionists don't want to stick around. As we discussed during the break also, I think that you must be a sociopath if you can be an abortion doctor and you do nothing else but that all day long.
Does that explain why training for the procedure of abortion, the surgical abortion, is not a popular training? It's usually optional in medical schools, but it's not a popular training for medical students?
Well, it clearly does, because a medical student, I presume, from all the kids that I've met and any students I see around here in the neighborhood, I mean, these are nice kids who want to help, who become doctors because they want to help. They also want to make money, sure, but there's nothing wrong with that. But they want to help. They want to have a satisfying vocation and not a killer's vocation.
People often kind of compare the public perception of the various vocations. We talked about journalists. Journalists are often held in very low regard nowadays. You said they used to be craftsmen and considered kind of the blue-collar craftsmen like the butcher, the baker, the bricklayer.
Yeah.
Doctors, similarly, is the medical profession as a whole going to suffer in its reputation that had been good up to this point because of the shift in the way doctors think?
Yes, arguably it is. I mean, physicians are held in the highest esteem in most countries in the world, you know. But if doctors become a killer profession, then obviously you no longer look at a doctor when you meet one at a cocktail party or something. Oh, here's this guy who just saved my granny, you know, or who fixed the bones of my uncle's bones or cured my mother of cancer. But you might say, well, I look at his hands and they are red, because they often are for different reasons. I say, well, whose blood is on those hands? Is it an unborn baby? Has he actually interfered with, as I said before, the closest approximation of paradise you can find on earth?
It seems a fine line, because a doctor, by his vocation, take a surgeon, for example, takes up a knife and cuts into a human body to do good.
That's right, to save the body.
For me, it would be a criminal act. For a surgeon, he's acting according to his vocation.
And his training, yeah.
How fine a line does there exist between someone doing this for the patient's good and doing it for the patient's harm?
Well, the line is the doctor in performing an operation? Is his intent to save the life, or to prolong the life, or to make what's left of one's life more comfortable? Or is he doing that to take a life? And I think that's the only answer. Are you doing this out of love for your fellow man, or are you doing this because you become a greedy killer? Because I don't believe that an abortionist who charges and makes a hell of a lot of money is doing this out of his enormous love for those women who in, very often are not in desperation come to him. I don't think so. I think it's greed, and I think it's a perversion.
You've said several times here on the program, finally, Uwe, that you're nearing 70. Have you passed that mark yet?
No, it's coming later in the year.
It is.
Yeah, after, just before Reformation Day, you know, there's still hope.
I notice you have an ice pack on your wrist right now.
Yeah.
The common experience of aging nowadays is the longer you last, the more and more you find yourself in the hands and in the office of the physician.
Yeah.
We have an aging population, baby boomers, 78 million of them strong, that will all be kind of reaching their age, their golden years at the same time. A greater portion of the population will be in doctor's offices, in hospitals, in nursing homes than ever before in our nation's history here in the United States. What will become of this, not only this generation, but of their later years in doctors' offices and doctors' care, if the medical profession has changed this way, away from the Hippocratic Oath?
Well, I think actually the medical profession is not really changing away from the Hippocratic Oath. I think what is happening is that you have a schism within the medical profession. As we mentioned earlier on, most students don't want to really learn abortion practices. There's hardly a hospital left in the country, a hospital where abortions are being performed. And, of course, the doctors that I have and have had in New York and Washington and have here in St. Louis, all of whom are the quintessential good doctors who actually care for your life and who sit down and discuss this and who want to heal you. I mean, it would be very – what is so terrible is, you see, being a German, I have always hated having fingers pointed at me for being a German because in my name, 6 million Jews were murdered. You know, and a lot of people, self-righteous people, say, well, you're one of those crowds. Well, I wasn't. Even if I had wanted to kill a Jew, normally they didn't allow three-year-old kids or six-year-old kids to do that sort of thing. Not even the Nazis were as perverse as that. But you see, what I feel is the same way, you know, I'm sure 90% of all doctors are very conscientious professionals who have a sense of vocation in the sense that we have been discussing it just now, who want to save lives, who want me. And now they have received a bad reputation for these greedy bastards who, pardon my English here, who are doing this, who have become killers. And killers are the most innocent, and at a massive scale, 45 million since Roe versus Wade. I mean, that thing should be written all over the front pages of the newspapers if they had any sense at all.
Finally, what can a Christian man or Christian woman with a sound scriptural understanding of vocation, living before God by faith in Jesus Christ, before the neighbor in love and service, what can that such a person, a man or woman, bring to the medical profession?
Well, first of all, that person in a democracy has a vote. So that is already, as a voter, you can limit, you can see to it that this nightmare will be ended. Secondly, seek out the doctors who are really loving doctors with a sense of vocation. It's not difficult. They're around. They're all over the place. I would say if you find out that somebody is an abortionist, boycott the guy. Don't go there. Make sure that this is not a doctor whose services you would require, even if he were a genius in any other fields. I wouldn't do that. If you're a woman, I certainly wouldn't use him as a gynecologist, you know. I think these are the things. And then talk about it. Keep it in mind that that 45 million dead people, murdered people since Roe versus Wade in 1973 is 45 million too many.
Uwe Simonetto is an international journalist, director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation, and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. Uwe, it's always a pleasure, and thanks for being here in the studio with us.
Cheers. Thanks.
All right, we've got a little open lines here to round off today's program. A bit more audio to play for you. This is, we've been dealing with some rather heady subjects. This one is a little bit lighter, although it verges into the legal realm. There may be trouble on the horizon for the upcoming movie, The Da Vinci Code. It's Dan Brown's best-selling book, of course, put on film. I've seen the trailer. Starring Tom Hanks. Ron Howard is the director. Can this thing fail to make money? Well, there may be trouble on the horizon for the upcoming movie. Richard Roth of CBS News reports that a lawsuit could block the film's release.
The upcoming movie version of The Da Vinci Code may be in jeopardy. A court fight over the best-selling novel could stop the release of the film. CBS News correspondent Richard Roth is live in London with more. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Renee. You've read the book. Now, before you see the movie, here's the lawsuit. It opened today here at London's High Court. Da Vinci Code author Dan Brown came to court this morning with a confident smile and a team of lawyers who will be arguing you can't claim ownership of history, even when it's controversial, disputed history.
Witness the biggest cover-up in human history.
The historic cover-up in the book and the movie coming soon is of the theory that Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene married and had a child, whose descendants are still around and still supposedly threatened by the Catholic Church. The tales made a fortune for Brown, whose book acknowledges the controversial theories not his alone, and even mentions a book that got there first, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, published more than 20 years ago, but as fact, not fiction. The authors of that book are suing for infringement of copyright, claiming the Da Vinci Code didn't just borrow a theory, it stole the whole thrilling jigsaw puzzle they created. Which, no suspense here, Dan Brown's publisher calls nonsense.
The publishers of The Da Vinci Code are saying, look, all we've done is take the basic facts in the original work, the premise about Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and turn it into a novel. And there's no copyright in the facts that we based it on, so where's the claim?
The claim is that about $18 million of what the book's already earned or the movie's expected to make ought to go to the authors who are suing. The legal wrangling could even jeopardize the film's opening here in May.
We are in the middle of a war, one that's been going on forever.
Brown's book has already survived a copyright challenge from another author in the U.S. who claimed plagiarism.
Could devastate.
But the case here could influence just how authors of fiction may use factual or historical research that's not their own, which lawyers say they've been doing pretty much since the time of Shakespeare. Renee?
The plot thickens. CBS's Richard Roth in London. Thanks.
All right, that's a report this weekend from CBS News. Very interesting. I mean, where does Dan Brown go with this? Because he's made assertions in the press that his book is not, in fact, fictional. Well, what he's actually said is that the only thing fictional in the movie, in the book, and I guess in the movie as well, are the characters. The characters that he's made up. Everything else, he says, the historical claims, the claims about the artwork, everything else is absolutely true. That has been Dan Brown's claim. Well, Holy Blood, Holy Grail put forth this theory that was the basis of Dan Brown's book. When it first came out and we were talking about it, everyone was making the connection between these two works, between The Da Vinci Code and Holy Blood and Holy Grail. Even Dan Brown admits to it. I was wondering how long it was going to take those authors to get around to getting a few dollar signs in their eyes. So they want $18 million of what the book has earned, and who knows what the film is going to earn. I wonder if Dan Brown could try and make the case that it's fiction. Hey, that's what he's saying. He said, I just took the facts that you gave me, and I turned it into a novel, a book, fiction. So which is it? Is it fiction, or is it fact? One thing's for sure, it will be a movie, and someone, maybe Dan, will have to share some of the money with others. It's going to make a lot of money for somebody. The only thing the the lawsuit's going to decide is how they have to divvy it up. Look, if you want to go see the movie, go see the movie. But just bear in mind it's fiction. And if you want to read the book, read the book. Just bear in mind, in spite of what Dan Brown claims, it's fictional. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines here for the last few minutes of the program. Here's a piece from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly. An interview with Ibrahim Hooper, who is communications director, spokesman for the Council on American Islamic Relations. They're known as CARE, talking about Muslim issues and especially American Muslim issues.
The Islamic world was also at the center of other controversies this week, whether the U.S. should cut off economic aid to the new Hamas-led government in the Palestinian territories, and whether the U.S. should let a company in the United Arab Emirates manage six American ports. We want to talk about all this with Ibrahim Hooper, the spokesman for the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE. Welcome. Let's begin in Iraq and the sectarian violence there. It seems to be spinning almost out of control. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it really is spinning out of control. I don't see any good solutions there. I think everybody's going to their own corner in terms of ethnicity and religion. And I don't know what the role of America is right now. If it goes to full-blown civil war, what does America do? Do we sit on the sidelines and let people kill each other? Do we intervene and make it worse, possibly? It's a very bad situation. Brings up the fact we shouldn't be in there in the first place.
You're a convert to Islam, an American-born convert, and you keep in touch with America's Islamic community as well as with the country as a whole, an opinion there. What do you think, and what do Muslims in America think about what this country should do, about what's going on there?
Well, I think in the American Muslim community, there's a consensus that we should get out as quick as possible, and I think that's a growing consensus in the American public as a whole.
What's going on among American Muslims now? You feel that the country, the rest of the country, is more understanding or more hostile? What do you feel?
It's a mixed bag, really. We have a situation, and we do polling on these kinds of things, on attitudes towards Islam. And what we're finding is that there's a hardcore, perhaps up to 20% of Americans, who have real hostility towards Islam. There's a good middle ground that's more or less neutral, and there's another end that's somewhat sympathetic. So I think we need to reach out to that middle ground.
Is the anti-Muslim attitude in this country increasing?
Unfortunately, I think it is, or at least becoming more vocal. It's more accepted now to attack Islam as an intrinsically violent faith, and that's a disturbing phenomenon, and that's what we would hope leaders, religious leaders, political leaders would speak out against.
Is that what you think is going on and is reflected in the big flap about the ports, port management?
I think Islamophobia and anti-Arab feeling is underlying that whole issue. I don't think it would be possible to exploit that issue for political gain without that underlying bias.
But what do you say to an American who says, look, two of the 9/11 hijackers came from Dubai. There's been smuggling going on through there of nuclear materials. Inevitably, if they're managing an American port, there's a greater likelihood that something or someone could get into this country that would be dangerous.
This is an international company that has facilities all over the world. The UAE is a stable ally supporting us in the war on terror. They've agreed to all kinds of safeguards. I don't feel any less safe with having this company thousands of miles away, employing American longshoremen to load and unload ships, and having cargo still screened by the DHS and the Coast Guard still watching the ports. It doesn't bother me at all, and I live here.
Yeah. What about aid to Hamas or the people in the Palestinian territories? What do you make of that?
Well, I think we need not to be seen as sabotaging a democratic election that was overwhelmingly in favor of a certain party. And I think we need to give any new government the opportunity to provide basic services to end corruption and to fulfill the national aspirations of the Palestinian people.
But isn't it against American law to give any foreign aid to a terrorist organization?
Yeah, it seems that it may be against the law to do that, but there are other avenues through NGOs and other ways to accomplish the goal. But right now we're going around the world saying strangle the new government, and I don't think that's the message we want to send.
CARE, your organization, has announced a campaign to educate the rest of us about the Prophet Muhammad and Islam. What do you most want people like me to know?
Well, I think we want to portray an accurate image of the Prophet Muhammad. Often he's portrayed as a violent person, someone who preached supremacy of Islamic beliefs and all of these kinds of things. When the Prophet himself was attacked and abused during his lifetime, he turned the other cheek.
There is a violent streak in Islam.
No, there's in any religion you're going to have a minority of extremists. What we want to show is that the vast majority of Muslims, whether it's in this country or worldwide, go to school, send their kids to school, go to work, our homemakers, our wives, husbands, fathers, sons. That's what Muslims do, just like anybody else.
Ibrahim Hooper, many thanks. Ibrahim Hooper is Communications Director and Spokesman for the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
That's Bob Abernathy talking with Ibrahim Hooper from CARE. Will we get an accurate image? They're going to try and educate us on Muhammad and on Islam. And he contends that the image of Islam is due to a minority of extremists. It's a pretty big minority. Maybe the minority actually goes the other direction. Let's talk with Jason, who calls from St. Louis. Jason, welcome to Issues Etc. Jason, our time's real short here.
Okay, my comment is regarding the Da Vinci Code movie lawsuit.
Yeah.
It seems to me contradictory that if you have a theory about the truth or history, that you could copyright it or would copyright it. Because, I mean, as in the people that are suing, is his name Dan Brown?
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Jason, sorry, our time is very short. We're getting up against the end of the program here. If they claim if this isn't just a theory and they claim this is actually what happened, how can you copyright history? If Jesus really did marry Mary Magdalene, they had children, and their children are still around today and being harangued by those who would cover up these facts in the Roman Catholic Church. And if that is the real history, you can't copyright it. If it's fiction, if it's just an idea that you put into a book and you don't want anyone stealing your idea, well, then you can copyright that. That brings up the real question about the Da Vinci Code. Is it really history or is it just fiction? Tomorrow we'll talk about Eastern Orthodoxy and icons with Dr. Gene Smith. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.